This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph Kleibert. Today is 28 August 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Kleibert is joining us by telephone from his home in Camden, South Carolina. I'm interviewing Mr. Kleibert today in order to gain his reminiscences of his experiences as he served in Vietnam in 1967 with the 12th Air Commando Squadron. Mr. Kleibert served as first sergeant during his tour. The 12th Air Commando Squadron was involved in what was known as Operation Ranch Hand, the defoliation of jungle areas, vegetation in South Vietnam. Mr. Kleibert, to begin this interview, I'd like to get a little background and biographical information from you. Can you tell me when you were born and where?
Okay, I was born the 18th day of October, 1929, in the town of Vacherie, V-A-C-H-E-R-I-E, Louisiana.
Very good. What were your parents' names?
My dad's name was Adrian Joseph, A-D-R-I-A-N, and my mother's name was Uranie, U-R-A-N-I-E, and her maiden name was Falgu, F-A-L-G-O-U-S-T.
That sounds like a very proper Cajun name.
Yeah, that's one of I'm French and German.
French and German.
Matter of fact, I could not speak English. I could speak some English, but not make sentences until I was seven when I went to school.
Is that right? What language were you speaking?
French mostly, and then some German, because I got the privilege of sitting between the two grandfathers under that big oak tree, and they could not converse very well at first. And they were still having trouble with that. And once they got the hang of it, they told me to go play with the other children.
They didn't need you around anymore.
Yes, sir. So anyway, that's how mine was strictly spoken, you know, not, I don't write French and I don't write German either by any means. But I mean, I have the more command of the French language than I did the German.
So do you still speak French and German?
I speak French, but not German, because I don't speak much French now, because I have only two sisters left in Louisiana, and when I call them on the phone, they'll talk to me a few words in French, and then they'll switch to English. And my mother, as long as she was living, dear soul, she would talk to me in French. So we conversed that way, and I kept that up, but otherwise I'm losing out on some of it. But I can still speak it. When I went back down there this time, I just lost my wife the 11th of June.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right? Yep, of 53 and a half years. And she stayed in the hospital 42 days, then had three strokes, and that took her out.
But oh, I'm anyway, so sorry to hear that.
She and I had gone this past December to visit there, and then she wanted to have that surgery. She had a colostomy, mm-hmm. and that... actually, it didn't work, and they had to reverse it, and when it did, she wound up with an infection and an abscess, and one thing led to another, and then stroke. But anyway, I'm bothering you with something that's not related to that. But anyway, I've visited down again since that, my two sisters, and they had a big reunion for me, so I got to talk to quite a few people, and some of them did want to speak French, so that helped me some.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was a farmer, and my mother was just a homemaker.
Mm-hmm. Now, your father was a farmer. What types of things did he farm there in Louisiana?
Okay, he farmed, he raised sugar cane,
mm-hmm.
and we did have some soybeans. We had, but sugar cane was the main crop,
mm-hmm.
and on that farm.
What was life like for you growing up on the farm?
Sir?
What was life like for you growing up on the farm in rural Louisiana in the 1930s?
Just a basic part of, and I appreciate that more now than I ever did, you know, at first, because we only had the bare necessities, but we always had food.
Mm-hmm.
And we grew, you know, our big gardens and stuff like that. But anyway... It was basically, as far as I'm concerned, if most people would come up that way, I think it would really help to get them to be able to understand what we have in the United States and should be proud of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were born in 1929, so as a young child, you were growing up during the midst of the Great Depression in Louisiana.
Correct. Yes, sir.
What was it like in terms of economically? What was it like growing up in that part of the country, a very poor part of the country, hit by this depression?
Very much so. Matter of fact, as I said, we had the bare necessities, and we appreciated that, but we had love from our parents and grandparents, and they were. It made a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't want it any other way, because I can take the hard times or the good times and get along fairly well.
Mm-hmm. Now, during the 1930s in Louisiana, of course, the most influential, most visible figure in the 1930s in Louisiana was Governor Long. Do you have any recollections of the governor?
Mostly, you know, what I read and what I was told, because by the time that I was old enough to realize, we didn't have radio, we didn't have nothing like that, you know. My granddaddy had a radio, so I did hear some of the things, but as I said, as a young child like that, I only, most of the things that I know is what I've read and what people have told me.
Mm-hmm. What about your parents on this farm? Politically, what were their political leanings? Do you remember?
Well, they were mostly, matter of fact, Democrat, mm-hmm. because the part was that when I got old enough to vote, my granddad told me, "Now you need to vote Democrat." I said, "No, sir. I want to vote for the people that are, you know, qualified to mm-hmm. do the job. That's my, you know, the people that we can use to better things."
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like that. He said, "No, you vote Democrat." I said, okay. And I didn't say no more to him. But I like to vote a cross ticket, really. I still do that if I can, you know. But now, even here in South Carolina with the primaries, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Whatever you vote in then is what you must vote in. So it restricts us some.
Mm-hmm. Now, this allegiance to the Democrats in your family, of course, in the Deep South, was traditionally Democratic, but also with the Roosevelt administration and the New Deal also created an awful lot of support
right.
in many rural areas for the Democrats.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, Governor Huey Long was also a Democrat. So
oh, yes.
Was this voting Democratic something that was a long history of this, a long tradition of this in your family?
Yes, sir. As far as I know, I was told that, you know, way back, even there, my granddaddy's folks voted, you know, that way. So it's been a tradition there. And as a matter of fact, a lot of that family still does it. When I was down there visiting, they were questioning me about that, you know. And I said, well, I'm not a straight Democrat. I mean, I believe in our... I believe we need both parties.
Mm-hmm. Well, what sort of things did you do growing up? I assume that you worked on the farm with your father.
Yes, sir.
What other sort of things did you do growing up as a child there in Louisiana?
What did I do on the farm?
Yes, sir. And for your pastimes, things you did to play,
well,
your interests?
I'd go fishing. I'd do hunting, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed that. But I, as I said, working on the farm kept me busy with, you know, chores that I had to do and helping out, you know, because at that time, I think my father his wages was, he worked for my granddaddy, in other words, and on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually earned 50 cents an hour.
And what about you? Did you make a wage there as well?
Mine was not like that. They paid me by what job I did, like a quarter or whatever it was.
Sure, and that's an awful lot of money for a
young
boy back
then.
Well,
it was, really. And then I would, when the men worked in the field, the different hired hands, they would go early in the morning. So I would carry breakfast to them. So I had little sacks, bags, and I'd carry that with their food in it, you know, in cans, in little old containers. And then they would pay me like a nickel a week or something like that.
Doing what you can, like so many people did,
to
get by. Where did you go to school?
I went to school at St. James High School in St. James, Louisiana, which is in St. James Parish.
Mm-hmm. How did you take to school? What sort of things did you enjoy?
What's that?
I'm sorry. What? How did you take to school? Did you like school? Were you a good student?
At first, it was real tough on me because I had to learn English.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a time with that. And Mrs. Pochet, who was really French, and she spoke very Parisian French. But she told me, she said, Claude, my name is Joseph Claude, and I went by Claude there. And anyway, she said, do you understand that if you keep getting me to speak French to you, you will never learn to speak English? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, well, this is the way it's going now. I'm not going to answer you in French, and you're going to learn to speak English. And so it was kind of tough the first year.
Mm-hmm.
But then it got better.
Were there other students who spoke only French as well?
Yes, sir.
So you weren't the only one in the school?
No, sir, not
school
the
then.
Only one.
Hmm. Very interesting. When did you graduate from high school?
I didn't graduate from high school. I got my GED
mm-hmm.
through the military. I went back to school when I got in the Air Force in 48. But I went to the 10th grade.
Okay. Now, how old were you when you left the 10th grade, when you left school?
I was 17 years old.
17 years old.
And then my dad told me, he said, son, you can do one of two things. You can either continue to school and finish. He said, I can't read or write, and you need to understand that you need to have that basic part. And he said, now your uncle, I don't have the money to send you, but he will send you to LSU if you will finish school, high school. And I said, well, I don't want to go to any more school.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he said to me, okay, you made your choice. Okay, you have three choices. You can either you can go to school, continue, and go to college, or you can work on the farm, or you can go to war. I said, well, so I worked a while, and then I said, well, I'm going to enlist in the Air Force. And that's what I did.
You enlisted in the Air Force. Now, when did you enlist in the Air Force?
Sir?
What year did you enlist in the Air Force?
In 1948.
In 1948. So
let's see, the 8th of January, 1948.
Mm-hmm. So the Air Force was pretty new then, having been created just a year
still,
before.
Matter of fact, we went under the Army Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
It changed a little bit later on, but I mean, our uniforms, we continued to wear the olive drab uniforms and mm-hmm. everything like that.
Why did you choose the Air Force?
Well, as I said, the story went like this. The recruiting sergeant, when I talked to him, I asked him, I said, well, can I leave tomorrow? And this was in Thibodaux, Louisiana. And he said, why are you running away from the law? I said, no, sir, I'm running away, if anything, from my dad. He said, and he almost fell out of his chair laughing, you know. I said, no, I really want to get away. I don't want to work on the farm, and I don't want to go to college. And I said, I want to get out of here. And I said, I want to go in the Air Force. And that was my reason, you know. But I chose the Air Force because I'd read some about it, heard some about it, and I figured this is the one service I wanted to go into.
Now, was it because of the travel or the excitement or adventure?
Well, not really at first, but it did have a lot to do with that afterwards. But
mm-hmm.
at first, it was people that I knew that had been in the Army Air Corps and were coming out of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And it impressed me with the uniform and also what their stories they told me about where they were and what they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good point when you're speaking about the Army Air Corps. Of course, came out of the Second World War.
Yes, sir.
What do you remember about the Second World War?
What do I remember
yes,
about
sir.
It? Well, I remember a good bit of it because we had scholastic studies in the school, you know, that we had little quizzes on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also at that time, my granddaddy had a radio, of course, and we would listen to the news. You know, he listened to every hour of news. And so I would listen to that and then read the papers. That really brought me up to, you know, what was taking place. And one thing that I remember, he'd always say he was French, and he couldn't speak, you know, well, he spoke English and he could be understood, but whenever he'd talk about General Eisenhower, he called him Elsewhere. So that was something that stuck in my mind, and every time I would think of General Eisenhower, you know, I'd say, Elsewhere. And he would say, yeah, Elsewhere has done this with his troops, and this has happened over there, and so he would brief me on different things. You know, we kind of laughed about it afterwards, but it was always, you know, interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another thing that started me with wanting to go in the military, because I really enjoyed listening to that, and that's one of the reasons I think I went into the military.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any family members who served in the war?
Yes, sir. My dad served in World War I, and my oldest brother served in World War II under Patton,
mm-hmm.
3rd Army in Europe. And then my youngest brother served in Korea in 1950.
Mm-hmm. So were there the three boys in the family?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Just dad and two brothers. Well, there was five children.
Mm-hmm.
Two brothers, myself, and then I was the middle one in the family, and then two sisters.
Okay. So there was a tradition of family service in
yes,
in,
sir.
For your family as well. Okay. So what did you said you read a little bit about the Air Force before you joined. What did you know about the Air Force?
Well, not really that much, but I liked planes.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever they had anything concerning planes, I was really interested in it. If I could find an article that had concerning bombers and fighters and things like that, I would really dig into it, you know, to learn more about it.
Mm-hmm. Was this part of that experience from the Second World War as well, do you think?
Excuse me.
I'm sorry. Was this part?
I have a problem hearing. You know.
No, I probably didn't phrase it very well either. This interest that you had in planes, like you said, bombers and fighters, was this also part of the World War II experience?
Yes, sir.
Where you would read about these things, hear about these kind of things,
yes, sir.
And probably very exciting for
I
a young
pictures
boy.
Pictures of them that different people would give me, you know, and I would always I had me a little file of that, and I always enjoyed looking at them. And as I said, it was an interest of mine from the beginning, and I think that's why I leaned towards the Air Force. But
mm-hmm.
what pushed it was what I told you, that my dad told me he'd either go to college or work on the farm or go to war, one or the other.
And the Air Force was the best choice for you at the time.
Yes, sir.
Okay, now you are joining the Air Force in 1948. Of course, this is the time where we begin to see much more publicly, we're much more aware of the growing rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, the
right.
Cold War. How aware were you at the time of what was taking place in the world,
now
global
that,
politics?
That is one thing that I have some knowledge of it, but not that much, because I didn't think too much of that at that time, you know, looking at it from that point.
Mm-hmm.
But after I went in the military, naturally, we were briefed and we were given different things. It made a lot of difference.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, once you got into the Air Force, was there anything in particular that you wanted to do? Did you want to become a pilot? Did you want to become a mechanic? What sort of thing did you want to, what track did you want to take in the Air Force?
Well, the track I wanted to take in the Air Force, I wanted to be a machinist.
Okay.
And when I went through my training at Lackland Air Force Base, I went through my complete training, 13 weeks of basic training. When I got through with that, I was on the list to go to machinist school.
Mm-hmm.
So then they said, well, since you are real good at drilling, we would like to keep you here while you wait to go to school. So they did. They kept me for 3 weeks. And then 3 weeks went by, and 3 weeks later, they still didn't have an assignment for, I mean, didn't have the school, that, and other folks had gone. So I went back in and talked to the captain about it, and the first sergeant told me, he said, if you go in there, you better make sure you understand that he is not doing too well today. I said, well, I'll need to speak to him anyway, because I want to make sure that I don't want to be an assistant drill instructor or a TI by any means. I want to go to school to get something that I can better myself for, that it, when if I do not stay in the military, I will have a trade.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I went in there, and he told me, he said, well, it's still not on there, but we need you here, but it will be on the bulletin board just as soon as we get yours. I said, okay. So I waited another week, and the following week it wasn't there. So I went back in and told him, well, if that be the case, I'm going to volunteer for anywhere in the world. He said, well, if you do, you'll get it. And I volunteered. And I wound up in Alaska a week later. Nome, Alaska, Marked Air Base. Right on the Bering Sea there.
Well, let me back up here a little bit, and I want to spend some more time on that as well, but let me back up ask you about basic training. Where did you say you went to basic training? Was it Lackland?
At Lackland, yes, sir.
Well, tell me about basic training back then.
Basic training was really rigid, but not to the point that, of course, being an old farm boy, it didn't bother me that much, and I learned to march and learned to do the things they wanted me to do in the training part.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything went fine. I enjoyed it. I never did regret that.
What was your routine in basic training?
Sir?
What was your daily routine in basic training?
Daily routine was getting up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we would get breakfast, and then from there we'd go to the drill field, and we'd drill, and when we got through with that, then we had different seminars and in classes in different things, you know, concerning the Air Force, concerning this, different structure, different things, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how long did basic training last?
13 weeks.
13 weeks.
Yes, sir.
And when you finished, when you graduated from basic, you said that your superiors decided that you had drilled very well.
Right.
Did they keep you around to serve as an assistant drill instructor?
Well, they did for, you know, that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a month before I got ready to get out of there. I went home on vacation. Then I came back and, you know, waiting to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted to do. But they wanted me to remain as a TI, and I told them, no, I really didn't want to do that. And that's why I had that conversation with the captain. And he laughed. He said, well, if you feel that way, he said, and you volunteer, you'll get it. And I did, of course.
Well, you were, obviously you must have done very well in terms of drill, being a drill instructor there.
Yes, sir.
What was your approach as a drill instructor? How would you approach your job in the new recruits?
Well, to approach the job, what made me to really realize I was instructed by a staff sergeant, Tegletter. He was from Ohio,
mm-hmm.
Toledo. And he told me, he said, the main thing about training troops, you need to understand and work with them and to make sure that they understand what you're telling them and the commands you give them, and whatever you do, make sure that they follow orders. And I did that, and of course I was the type that really, I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
But I said I didn't want to be an instructor. I didn't want to stay there.
Sure, you felt that it would limit you in the future.
It would,
as you say.
And I felt that from what my dad had told me also, you know, about going to school and bettering myself,
mm-hmm.
I figured, well, I've already messed up already. I better not do that again and get into something that I cannot use, you know, saying I would only stay my regular 3 years in the military and then get out.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a trade, I could go back to that.
Right. Okay, now, you said that these machinist orders never came through.
Never did.
That you were hoping for it, and you were just, I guess, swallowed up by the Air Force.
Right.
And you said, I volunteered to go anywhere, and they did send you anywhere. They sent
That's
you
right.
to Alaska.
And I said, well, I asked for it, and I got it. And he even talked to me after that. He said, see? I said, well, I said, sir, I said, well, I did not want to stay as an instructor, and I said, I appreciate you saying that you wanted to keep me, but I really don't want to do that, and so I would rather just go on from there. So what I did then, when I went to Nome, Alaska, Marks Air Base, they wanted me to train as an assistant crew chief on a C-47.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and I did that for a while, and then I was supposed to go to Texas back for school for mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'd done that for about 3 months, and they decided, no, that they needed people in other fields, and that's when I went into the personnel administration field.
Okay. Well, before we get you to that point, tell me about March there in Nome, Alaska. What was your routine there? What were you doing there?
The routine there was I worked in other words, as an assistant crew chief on a C-47, training for that, and then I would have gone to, I forget, Shepherd Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they would send them. They told me that you'd go there for your final training of that part, then you'd be qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I didn't follow through with that. Well, they didn't let me. There were a lot of people getting out of the military at that time, and then they had too many of one in one specialty, FSC. So they went ahead and changed, you know, moved people around. And that's how I wound up in personnel administration. And I worked in the orderly room then as a clerk, starting out in personnel.
Okay, now where was this again?
Marks.
It was at Marks, okay.
Marks Air Base,
okay.
In Nome, Alaska.
All right. Now, what did you think about this transfer to personnel?
Well, at first, I didn't want to do that because that was the lowest score that I had. and I said, well, really? But it was a blessing because by doing that, it helped me to continue to work and really understand that the knowledge I had was not sufficient enough. So then I went back to taking different classes,
mm-hmm.
and I did that, you know, through the military.
Okay. Now, what was your daily routine working in personnel?
Daily routine was preparing morning reports and taking care of a lot of, other files and different things like that,
mm-hmm.
when I started out.
So compared to what life would have been like on the farm in Louisiana, would you say that this was an improvement?
Oh, yes, sir. I did not want to work on a farm. I don't know why, but and I did work at it and didn't have any problem with it, but I did not want to stay there because
mm-hmm.
I knew that would be what I would keep doing, you know, all my life if I
right.
stayed there.
And so far, you've already been around the country and had a paid vacation to Alaska so
That's
far.
That's right.
Well, where did you go? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. But
where did you go after Marks?
Okay, when I left Marks, I went back. That's when I went back to Texas.
Okay.
No, wait a minute. I'm wrong. I left Marks and came back, and they assigned me to. I went to postal school in Virginia. And then I wind up working in the post office instead of staying with the orderly room and the personnel and the administration, which
so
was a related field, and it still is related, David, with the different personnel administration. And postal would go so far,
mm-hmm.
and when I became a tech sergeant, then, of course, I had to change over completely, and that's when I went into the personnel administration and then first sergeant.
Okay, well, tell me about this time here in Virginia. You're working in the postal area.
Right.
What was that like?
Well, that was really interesting, and I thought I would like that, and I stayed with it for a few years. Matter of fact, I was promoted. I went from there then, and I went to Then that's when I went back to Texas.
Okay.
To San Angelo, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
At Goodfellow Air Force Base.
Okay, now when did you arrive in San Angelo, Goodfellow?
Oh, let's see. That would have been, 1949. It would have been 1950.
In 1950?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now in the summer of 1950, of course, the Korean War begins. North Korea
right.
invades South Korea past the 38th parallel.
Right.
How did this affect you?
Well, it didn't affect me because they did not select me to go there. And so I stayed at Goodfellow and worked in the postal field and was promoted to tree striper and then from there to staff sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when I got my other assignment then to, that was in 52, I got the assignment to Eielson Air Force Base in Alaska again.
Okay, now what do you remember about the Korean War? There you are, sergeant in the Air Force. How closely were you following the war?
Well, pretty close because I had a brother there.
Mm-hmm.
He was at Incheon, my youngest brother.
So your brother went in on the landing then?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And then when I went to Alaska, I left from, I mean, from San Angelo, I went to Eielson Air Force Base in the Fairbanks area, called Mile 26.
Mm-hmm.
But at, anyway, I had an opportunity to, they were asking for people to go over there. Of course, I'd be dealing with postal. They were with postal, but to deliver, to get mail routed to different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was hoping that I could get that. Well, I volunteered for it, and they agreed to send me. And when I went over there, I told the captain that I reported to that I had a brother there, and I wanted to go see him at Incheon. And he said, "You do." He said, "You're not supposed to be here then." And this was just a temporary thing. We would be gone for 30 to 60 days,
mm-hmm.
and then they would rotate the people. So they sent me back to Alaska, and I didn't get to stay in Korea then. I went back to Korea later on in 60. Yeah, 60.
But you were there in, you said, 1952?
Yes, sir.
Very briefly then.
Just actually a week. And they said, no, since you're, at that time they didn't want, the families, especially like this. He said, no, because of this situation, you have to go back to Alaska today. And you know, so I went back the following week, and they rotated other crews in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed at Eielson then, and of course that's where I was promoted to tech sergeant there.
Now, I assume your brother then was part of the U.S. Army?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And I guess the looking across the services, they didn't realize that one was Army, one was Air Force, and that you would both be there at the same time. Okay. So were you disappointed that you were forced to leave Korea?
Well, very disappointed, because I didn't get to see my brother, see, and I wanted to see him, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be there with during that time and serve there, you know, get around and fly the mail here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't get to do that.
So
my mouth got me in trouble.
Yeah, I guess so. So you wind up back in Fairbanks.
Mile 26, which is actually 26 miles out of Fairbanks, but it's Eielson Air Force Base.
Okay, okay. And you said you were promoted to tech sergeant there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now it sounds like for an enlisted man, you're doing pretty well, pretty quickly.
Well, it was 3 years, 11 months, I was a tech sergeant.
Mm-hmm. So are you feeling pretty good about your time in the Air Force at this point?
Yes, sir.
It sounds like you're progressing very well, that you're taking to it, that you're doing a good job at whatever role they put you in by this
point.
Well,
I tried to do my best, and that was one thing my dad told me when I left. He said, "Now, remember who you are, where you come from, and you do your best." I said, "Yes, sir." And so I always tried to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've gotten past your 3 years in the Air Force that you talked about. Are you considering making the Air Force a career at this point?
At that time, yes, sir. I'd made up my mind I wanted to stay in.
What was it about your time that made you want to stay?
Well, it was just that I liked the Air Force, and I liked the service itself. And
mm-hmm.
by doing that, like you said, I would be traveling. I would also gain more knowledge as I went into different fields.
Mm-hmm.
And the personnel administration, admin and personnel, well, personnel, was actually a field that was wide open as far as, you know, you could go from, you could be working in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, not just one thing. Like when I became a tech sergeant, well, then when I moved from Alaska to Donelson Air Force Base in Greenville, South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
I worked there for about 3 or 4 months, and they told me that I would have to go work in the personnel field. I could not stay as a tech sergeant. They were overloaded with people,
mm-hmm.
and the rank would make me go into it. So that's when I went into the IG's office.
Okay. What did you think about this move?
Sir?
I'm sorry. What did you think about this move?
Oh, I at first was, you know, I knew my field in postal very well, and I had to dig again, you know, to really get back into the grind of the personnel administration.
Mm-hmm.
Which made a big difference. But then the major that I worked for, he was the IG, and he talked to me, and he said, "Now listen, don't let that bother you. you can still take some courses that will help you, and I'm going to show you, and I'm going to help you. And he did. And so we built that office from just he and I in the office when it started out. And, of course, we had our flying safety officer was in there, too, and two secretaries, and I had three men working for me, and airmen. And it was quite a change, but then I realized that this would be better for me and a wider field, and that's when I got into it completely. And then from then on, I stayed in that field, but I moved from different areas,
mm-hmm.
you know, from IG's office to this, the first sergeant, back and forth. So I had a dual FSE, first sergeant and personnel and administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, once again, it sounds like you found something that you could do.
Well, yes, sir.
And do pretty well by the sounds of it.
Well, I have a letter from Colonel Dennis, Robert Dennis, who was our commander, the 12th Air Commando, and he wrote a letter to my wife, and then of course my APR showed that he had served. You know, if he was to serve as a commander again, if he could have a first sergeant like me, he would really, you know, enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, I was glad that I was able to do the job like that.
Must make you feel pretty proud, I would think.
Sir?
Must make you feel pretty proud, I would
yes,
think.
Yes, sir, it does. And I was, and of course, he has since died. He was in from Washington, Yakima, Washington.
All right, now.
He reminded me of Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, is that right?
Type of fella. He was soft-spoken, but he meant what he said when he said it, and but he was very kind and very understanding about the job,
mm-hmm.
and a very good pilot, too.
Now, as you're working your way through the Air Force, this is the 1950s, of course, the Eisenhower-Truman administration, Eisenhower administration, we have the Korean War, but we also have the heating up of the Cold War in a lot of other ways as
right.
well. How aware were you at this time, through your career in the Air Force, of these Cold War tensions?
Well, I realized to a degree that, in other words, we were going to have a lot more conflict than we'd had and in areas, you know, and probably would be subject to being shipped in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
But I figured, well, I've signed on the dotted line, and I'm their man.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particular place you'd have liked to have gone?
Not really. Well, I wanted to go to Europe,
mm-hmm.
naturally, but I never did go to Europe.
You never did make it over?
And all my assignments was out Far East and Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Twice to Alaska, 2 years, 1 year. Well, four. I was supposed to be there a year in Nome. I stayed there 14 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then they held me over. They didn't, couldn't get a replacement, so sad. Anyway, then I went from there. Let's see. Then the other ones was, well, twice to Alaska. The other one was at Eielson. That's 2 years there. And then the Korea was 1960. I left from Donelson Air Force Base and went there and spent 13 months there. And then went to the Air University at Maxwell Air Force Base and stayed there 4 years. And I was ready for retirement, volunteered to come to Shaw Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I got caught. They wouldn't they wouldn't accept my retirement. So I had 8 months left to go, and I had to extend and go to Vietnam. Of course, they promoted me to Master Sergeant, too, so.
Right, sure. All right, now, that's a bit of a jump there, but let me ask you about a few of the things that maybe you remember about these different events in the world. One, of course, is in 1961 with the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Right.
What do you remember about that?
Well, that was, you say 60...
In 1961.
61?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I that's when I, okay, April of 61 is when I came back from Korea, and I went to the Air University Command at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped out in the command post there. In other words, some, you know, but my regular job was assigned as working with Allied officers. I was the NCOIC of that area of the school,
mm-hmm.
and we trained, well, I think at that time, 60 different countries that would come send troops there to be trained for further, you know, pilot training, this and that afterwards. But they had to come through the language school. We had a language school there, and that's what I worked in to the... as far as the getting, I was not subject to go anywhere with the Bay of Pigs. You know,
mm-hmm. Now, you worked there at the language school. What was your job?
Well, my job was actually in that particular, I was the NCOIC, the sergeant in charge of the ones that worked in it, the airmen, to get all the things, the machine, the recorders and this and that. And the other. I was over all of that. But I did not work in the language part,
mm-hmm.
and that's where I failed again. See, Dr. Moore, he was the man in charge of all the labs, and he spoke French beautifully. He was married to a French girl,
mm-hmm.
anyway, and he wanted me to study. You know, to say, why don't you use some of these tapes? We had one of the best tape labs, and I wouldn't do that. He got aggravated with me about that.
Why did you decide not to do it?
Well, I don't know. It was just that I just didn't, at that time, you know, I just, I had a little daughter that was 3 years old. Yeah, 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd got married in 55.
Okay.
And so I didn't want to do things that would, you know, I'd have to put more time in to do. And I should have, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'd gotten married in 1955.
Yes, sir.
But in, 1960, you were in Korea. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. The year you spent there. What was it like leaving your wife and family?
Well, at first, I guess it was because my little daughter was only 16 months old then. And so it made a big difference, you know, as a father and as a husband. But I told him again, I said, what I have to do is when I sign on the dotted line, I'm committed to this, and this is what I have to do. So I went, and I was, after that, it was all right. I missed him some, you know, but other than that, it was okay.
Mm-hmm. And what were you doing that year you were in Korea?
The year I was in Korea, I was assigned to Division Intelligence.
Okay.
And that's what I worked in there.
Were you still, was it the personnel branch
still
of intelligence?
Still personnel. I was the sergeant in charge of, you know, the NCOIC of the Division Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I got involved in a good bit of that because we had, you know, maintained target folders and a bunch of other stuff that I had never fooled with before.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump back into your time at Maxwell here, there at the language school.
Right.
How long were you there?
Sir?
How long were you at Maxwell, at the language school?
I was at Maxwell from 61, April of 61, until '65. Let's see, it would have been August. I think August of 65 I left there.
So you were there for a good long while then?
Oh, yes, over 4 years. Once you was in a command over 4 years at that time, they had a regulation that you could apply to go to the base of your choice, especially if you was approaching retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I moved to Shaw Air Force Base, because I already had checked that out with the DuPont plant here in Camden, and I had lined up, you know, to get a job there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, while you were at Maxwell, again, a year later, 1962, of course, is the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
What do you remember about that?
I remember some of it because we were, you know, some of the people were involved with it from there, but I was not. I remained the school, you know, into that school,
mm-hmm.
the Allied Officers Division School, And I, you know, have some different vague memories of it, you know, of what actually took place.
What do you remember from your perspective?
Well, just the way that things were handled, you know, we had already divided a country in Korea, and I figured, well, here we go, you know, getting in, we were getting involved in too many things, I thought. In other words, even though we needed to get involved, but when we do, we should go full force, just like we did World War II.
Mm-hmm.
That was my perspective of war or anything of that type. Now, I don't mean that we should go to war each time, a little conflict, but I think the way things were going there, which was in our own hemisphere, it was really a dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. You said that you wanted the U.S. to go in full force. With a total commitment. Were you satisfied then with the settlement of Korea, the Korean War?
Not really. I've always spoke out about that, and I still do, and of course then we went ahead and divided Vietnam, and
mm-hmm.
and then had to run out of there. So that was another thing that set a bad taste to me, was that I didn't think we should do that.
Mm-hmm. What about the handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis? There you were at Maxwell.
Right.
What do you think about the way the Air Force and the government, the Kennedy administration, handled the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, finally, I think they did the best that they could, and I think it worked out better because they accomplished what they set to do,
mm-hmm.
was to move Russia, the equipment out of there.
All right. Now, you're going to stay at Maxwell until 1965.
Right.
And you mentioned that you were looking around for maybe a future career once you got out of the Air Force.
Right.
And you were looking at, was it DuPont, you say?
Yeah, DuPont.
And you're looking at the DuPont Corporation that had a plant in Camden.
Camden, South Carolina.
Okay. So it seems to me that your choice to go in the Air Force and to do these various different things, working in personnel, postal, administrative positions, it seems that these choices have worked out pretty well for you so far.
Yes, sir, it has. And it was the best thing that could have happened to me, really.
Mm-hmm. So you're looking at DuPont. Did you know someone who worked at DuPont?
No, I didn't know anyone there at the time. And when I moved from Maxwell to here, to Camden, well, to Shore Air Force Base, I still had my mobile home, the trailer,
mm-hmm.
we lived in. We bought it when we got married. The reason I'm giving you this, and then we'd look for a house here in Camden. So we did and found one, and we bought it. And 2 weeks later is when I thought sure I was going to get my retirement orders. I didn't. I got a greeting to go to Vietnam. So I didn't get to get my job then, but they told me I'd already sent my resume and I had everything set up, and they said you'll have your job when you get back if you want it. I said I do.
Well, that must have felt pretty good.
Sir?
That must have felt pretty good.
Yes, sir.
Now this is 1965, so you'd been married for 10 years.
Right.
Moved around a little bit, but not all that much after you got married,
well,
I guess.
I was fortunate as far as that part.
So you find yourself in Camden, South Carolina. You have a job lined up. You've got a family. Did you have just the one girl at this time, or did you have other children?
Just one child. We still have just, she's retired from the Air Force as a lieutenant colonel.
Oh, wow, that's terrific.
And her husband is, too. They're up in Dayton, Ohio. I was just visiting with them last week.
That's fantastic.
Yes, sir.
So you've got this one child. You've got a wife. You've got a job waiting for you in Camden. You just bought a house, and you get orders for Vietnam.
Right.
And this is 1965.
Yep.
That must have, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that sounds like it must have been a blow to you.
It was, at first. And I told the wife, I said, well, honey, I said, the thing is, I'll sign on the dotted line, and my service is not over, and I'm just going to have to go over there and put in an extra year. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and she said, well, we bought the house from the people, and we just signed for it. Why don't we bought it directly from a couple? And she said, "Why don't we ask him to take it back?" I said, "No, we're going to need a house." She said, "Well, what if something happens to you when you're over there?" I said, "Well, you're not going to live in a cave. You need a house. And if you don't want to live there, sell it, find you a young man, and get away from here." She said, "You're something." I said, "No, this is life." But I said, "I'm planning to come back now. Don't you run off now." So anyway, the area, what it was, I wanted to, when we transferred from Montgomery, the whole thing was this. I was interested, concerning my daughter's interest. I wanted to move her at least I could as far as the education.
Sure.
So we moved her and moved her to Sumter. She had to go to Sumter County. She was registered there when we moved. So then I registered her here in Kershaw County in Camden. And then I had to turn around and my mother-in-law was going to come stay here. She lived in Kershaw, which is 19 miles away. And she was going to come live with here during that 1 year that I was gone. Well, then at the week before I got ready to leave, she said, "I just can't do that, Joe Cleaver." I said, "That's all right, Mama. Don't worry about it. Just pack up this stuff, and you can go over there. We're going to keep the power on in this house and everything, put the phone on vacation. And you can come back here if you want to later on, and if you decide to do that, it'll be fine." And anyway, then it worked out. I had to move my daughter. Well, they moved her. They moved her, transferred her to Lancaster County, which was in Kershaw. And so she went to school there for that year. Then had to transfer back here when I came back. And so that was quite a change for her. So that's why I was concerned.
Mm-hmm. What was your family's reaction when you got the orders for Vietnam?
Well, my wife was devastated. She said, I just knew that things would not work out. I said, "They will work out anyway." I said, "It doesn't make any difference." I said, they've given me the orders, and that's where I have to go, and I can't retire, so I have to go. And I said, "I'll serve my time and come back." And I did, and it worked out even fine because I earned a Bronze Star there.
Now, you moved to Camden in 1965. Right?
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
And you got your orders in 1965
right.
For Vietnam. So you're going to stay in for an extra year. All right. Now, what did you do from the time you got your orders before you left for Vietnam?
Well, I got there in August, and it was actually December before I got to leave. I worked in the Director of Materiel's office at the NCOIC there.
Okay. Now, this would have taken you to December of 1965.
Yes, sir.
So you would have shipped out to the West Coast and to Vietnam then probably early 1966 then.
I went I've got that wrong. Wait a minute. I didn't leave here until the December of 66.
Okay, so it was 1966.
Right.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, I guess that makes more sense with the timeline. That follows.
Right.
Okay. What did you know about what was going on in Vietnam? Had you been following American policy? Had you been following the war as it was taking place?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, what did you know about it?
Well, the way things were going, it was going to be a long, drawn-out affair because I read also, you know, the French had actually told the Americans, that if you go in there, it's going to be a long, drawn-out affair because they were getting out of it. When I was in Korea, matter of fact, to go back a little bit, they asked me, did I want to go over there as an advisor? And I told them no, and since I had a little bit of, I said, no, I really don't want to do that. And they said, well, we'd move your family then they'd move them to Korea, and I said, nope, I don't want to do that. And then they would, of course, extend my time there. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. I'm going home. And so I left and come out of Korea. But that would have been as an advisor then.
Mm-hmm. So you turned down that opportunity.
Sir?
So you turned down that opportunity early on.
No, I didn't want that.
Sure.
I didn't want them to have to go to Korea anyway, and she would have to go to school there. And plus, things were unstable anyway at that time. Still unstable, and still is now.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the U.S. had been involved in Vietnam for quite some time.
Oh, yes.
But we don't have officially troops on the ground, although we did have troops on the ground until early in 1965.
Right.
You said that you were watching the war pretty closely, and you had this very strong feeling, this understanding that it was going to be, as you said, a long, drawn-out affair.
Right.
Had you been following it militarily? Had you been following what the American military command in Vietnam was doing and the running battles and things like this?
Some of it, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of the way we were handling it then?
Well, I thought that they were handling it correctly, but the problem is that the military should be making the decisions instead of political. It should not be another political thing like it was in others. Korea and every different other one. But that's where we run into problems. And, of course, being a military man, and I believe that, and knowing that politics, we need politics, but we don't need politics to be dictating to a general that's on the ground calling the shots, and they said, no, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my beef about that. I didn't appreciate that, didn't like that, and that continued to happen while I was over there.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about the American presence there? What was the United States trying to accomplish as you understood it then?
Well, I thought at first what they were trying to accomplish was to stabilize the country and then, you know, move out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't look like that after that.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a continuous thing as we've done before, go from one country to the other and just stir it up, well, do what we're supposed to be doing. But then politics gets in it and just sends it the other way, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think politics, the political part should be to provide what's needed for these commanders on the ground. And then that's it. They should not, now the president, yes, should make decisions. That's not what I mean. And other people, they work with him, but they should not dictate certain things that against the wishes of that particular commander that knows what battle is and what should be done.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you've been following the war somewhat closely. You know, you have a good idea of what's going on there. And you're someone who was aware of World War II and aware of the Korean War. And you see the Vietnam War developing, 1964, 1965 especially, 1966. And now you're going over there. You said that your wife was devastated. You certainly did not look forward to this. You were hoping to disappear into civilian life and have another career after
that.
That's
right.
But regardless, you're going to go to Vietnam. What was it like leaving your family in South Carolina there in December of 1966?
Well, now that was real harder than going to Korea.
Why?
Well, I don't know. It was just I had all my plans, you know, that I was going to retire from the military.
Mm-hmm.
I had my home already here, and then I would go to work to DuPont, which is only 6 miles away, and that just upset the whole apple cart.
Mm-hmm. In December of 66, you leave, you go to the West Coast, I assume.
Yes, sir.
For your trip to Vietnam. Where did you fly out of, do you remember?
Out of Travis Air Force Base.
Out of Travis Air Force Base.
Yes, sir.
Now, as you made your way to California, while you were in California for this short time.
I went from here to visit my mother and my family in Louisiana.
Okay, I was going to ask you that.
Right. I went to visit them for 3 days, and then I left there by train and went to California.
So you took a train to California,
yes,
then?
Yes, sir.
Okay. How aware were you at this time in late 1966 of the anti-war feelings, anti-war sentiment in the United States?
Well, at that particular time, I don't, you know, there's only some of the vague things that I remember. Some of them, you know, I forget what they call them, they left the country, went to Canada and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of upset me to a degree because here they're Americans. They're young people, yes. They don't want to go to war, but they want to live in a country like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was that particular part. But other than that, I don't think there was as much of that as when I came back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly. Certainly the case. Describe for me the trip to Vietnam from Travis Air Force Base.
Well, that was it was a very good flight. It was they arranged flights that we'd fly in. You know, they were commercial flights.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go on a military aircraft. I went on a regular airline and went into Tan Son Nhut, which originally I was being assigned to the IG's office there. And I was going to stay in Saigon in a hotel, which I did for a week. And that would have been a good assignment. But then one of the personnel people that he and I had worked for many years in different areas, he was the chief master sergeant, and he was in charge of his personnel. And he contacted me, and he asked me, he said, would you like to go back into the first sergeant's field? I said, well, not really. I said, I'm assigned here now with the IG, and I will remain with personnel administration, and I'll do that. And then he gave me some particulars about it, what would take place and this and that and the other. We'd be flying here and there to do inspections. And I said, well, I don't know if I wanted that, but whatever you want, tell me some more about it. So anyway, that's when he got a hold of, the colonel had already got a hold of him, Colonel Dennis. He needed a first sergeant up at Benoit, which was the 12th Air Commando Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just getting it started real good. So he needed a first sergeant, and that's how he interviewed, I think, six of us, and he finally come down and asked me, would I be the first sergeant? And I agreed. And he said, now, you know you'll be living in a tent for a while until we can get these louvered huts built. And I said, yes, sir, that's fine. I said, I come here, I know I'm even in Saigon. I said, we're still in a combat area. And so he said, well, it'll be a lot different living. I said, yes, sir, I understand that. And I said, if you need me, I'm willing to go if you want me. And so he checked my record out and everything. And so that's why I wound up going to Benoit as the first sergeant.
Okay. Let me back up here a little bit and ask you what it was like for a young man from, I guess you weren't all that young now, you've been in for almost 20 years.
Right.
What was it like for you as someone who was raised in rural Louisiana to be dropped down in the middle at Tan Son Nhut, Saigon? What was Saigon like?
Well, it was, in other words, Saigon at that time, you know, really, even during a time like that, people were, you know, riding their scooters and motorcycles and things in the taxi cabs, which I was impressed with. I mean, the way they drove and the way they carried on, you know. But it reminded me somewhat of New Orleans. And, you know, of course, I know it was in a combat area. But still, at that time, I hadn't realized any part of that, you know, as far as bombings or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, here we go again, you know. I didn't get to stay there. I went to the area where we really had problems in February of 67, really.
So in February of 67, you joined the 12th?
I joined them in December, 2 weeks after I got there.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes.
It would have been January I went there. Because I was with the IG's office for a week, and getting settled. I hadn't even made any inspections yet.
Mm-hmm. So you find yourself in Benoit early on in your tour.
Right.
And you were the 12th Air Commando Squadron. What did you know about the 12th Air Commando Squadron?
I didn't know anything about it other than when I had visited at where they train over in Florida, next to Eglin, the other base. Can't even call it more. Well, anyway, they trained the air commanders there. And I'd read some parts about that. Other than that, I didn't know anything about that operation.
Okay, now, what is your role here going to be with the 12th?
As a first sergeant.
As a first sergeant, all right. And you're still going to be working in personnel?
sir.
And you're still going to be working in personnel?
Well, it would be personnel. Well, I mean, no, I'd be the first sergeant there then.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Completely in as a first sergeant.
Okay, very good, very good. All right, now, what are your duties going to be here as first sergeant is what I need
duties
to ask.
Duties is the responsibility of the troops, in other words, all the enlisted, and for their discipline, for their welfare, for their housing, and everything that they need.
Mm-hmm.
That's the duty of a first sergeant.
Sure.
And that, when we started, we only had three airplanes, three C-123s. Well, that's all they had at the time when I went there. That's all he had.
Mm-hmm.
And there was 12 men, including me. That was some officers and a few enlisted that were aircraft mechanics and things. Okay. Then we built the squadron up, kept adding, and we started getting more planes and more troops, and we wound up with 170 people and 29 aircraft by the time I left there.
So you were there at a very important time as they're building this up.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why Colonel Dennis was searching for someone who had had experience in different things. And I said, Chief Master Sergeant Eugene said, well, if you want a man, that man there has been exposed to a lot of things. And that's how I wound up being there.
Hmm. Now, of course, the 12th Air Commando Squadron was involved in Operation Ranch Hand.
Yes, sir.
Spraying defoliants throughout the war zone. What did you know about this? Anything?
At that time, no. I learned everything after I got there.
Okay.
I knew nothing about that operation, you know, completely. I knew of some of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then wound up briefings and different things and got my feet wet, as you might say, and then with the commander. And we worked it out, and we had four planes at Da Nang. We had detachments from the squadron. So I had three there. I had four there. Cameron Bay, we had three. And then we had what's the other area? I had four detachments. One was still at Tansanute.
Mm-hmm.
That was only three planes there. But the rest of the squadron was at Benoit.
Okay.
And we rotated those crews back and forth. So I had the job that I had. I flew more then than I did when I was on flying status. Because I had to go about four times a week, I'd be flying somewhere.
Right. I was going to ask you that, if you were flying around taking care of these duties these various different places. So you saw quite a variety of different things in different places then.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, tell me how...
The other one was Cameron Bay. I got it.
Okay. Tell me how things changed from place to place as you flew around. From Cameron Bay and Benoit, Tansanute, Da Nang. Tell me about how the war changed, or what the perspective of the war was in these different places.
Well, at times it looked like we were winning and things were getting better, and other times everything just fell through. It was we'd wind up with gaining some ground and then losing some.
Mm-hmm.
Even with our perspective of what we did, because we didn't only spray, we sprayed, of course, the Agent Orange, which was dioxin,
mm-hmm.
and we had mixed that with different chemicals to do different things. We did crop too, you see, we did rice crops,
mm-hmm.
and that was a more difficult one because you were flying at about 50 feet above, and at that time they had a setting where you had to fly. They wanted us to fly a straight, you know, stripping instead of checkerboard. Well, that's when we run into trouble, and we wound up with Captain Kubley and his crew. He was shot right through the head. They couldn't shoot him from the bottom because, they could, but, I mean, we had armor piercing where the cabin was, and also where the flight mechanic was in the back.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the aircraft was just the skin of the aircraft. That's it. But then they shot them. They would set up, in other words, by using stripping You'd fly one way and fly right back and do the rice crop. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, they'd set up somewhere and then they'd shoot them. And that's what happened. So we had to change that policy and go to checkerboard.
Okay. Now, when you say you were doing the rice crop, what do you mean by that?
Well, the Viet Cong, the South Vietnamese were raising the rice for themselves and to sustain themselves,
mm-hmm.
and also to sell. So the Viet Cong would come in, and they were living in tunnels and things, so they would come in and take over these fields when they were ready to harvest. Just about the time they were ready to harvest, they would either the South Vietnamese would let them have it, or they would kill them and take it. So we would have to, whenever that took place, we would have to spray it to kill, to destroy it, so that they could not harvest it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now how did you, and you may not know this, but how did you know when a field was taken over by the Viet Cong and that it was therefore in need of being sprayed, destroyed?
We had green berets on the ground,
mm-hmm.
Different intelligence outfits that would give us give the information to our headquarters, the wing squadron, the wing, what was taking place, and that's how we knew where our targets would be.
Okay. So intel was providing it to you at the 12,
yes, sir.
And then you guys would act on it from there.
Yes, sir.
And okay.
That had to be done then. You know, that's the type of things we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were doing a lot of flying around back and forth. Were you doing this in small planes? Were you riding along on cargo planes from one base to the other?
No, mine was all cargo planes, C-123s.
All C-123s.
Yep. Matter of fact, at first, when I started doing it, they asked me that I mind if they would, do a few spraying
mm-hmm.
while we were going to the other place. I said, I don't mind. And we did that for a while, and then the commander and I flew a few times together, and they learned about that from the wing, our wing, and they said, nope, you can't do that. You two of you can't fly together to start with. And the other thing is, you will not be flying on a mission anymore over fields to go. When you go, you'll be going straight to that base, to that detachment,
mm-hmm.
to do whatever you need to do and then come back. You're not going to be doing spraying. So they stopped that.
Okay, but you did fly a few spray missions, though.
Flew about five of them.
About five of them.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, take me through a typical spray mission.
Well, they would load the aircraft, with we had a tank in there, and they would fill that up with those drums and get the crews ready, and then we would get ready to go, and then from there they would have a particular, they had been given the orders which place to go and which place to spray, what kind needed to be sprayed, and then we would do that and move on to the next one.
Okay. Now, would you generally do one particular area at a time, or would you have enough to do one place and then move on to the next, or do you have to come back for refuel to pick up more defoliant?
It depends on the extent of the spraying.
Mm-hmm.
If it was defoliant used for trees and brush, it was a little bit different. If it was for crops, the rice, that was a little bit faster and easier.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they could do two places, two fields.
Mm-hmm. And you said the plane that you generally flew on was shot up pretty good then.
Sir?
I think you mentioned before that the plane that you flew on was shot up pretty good.
Oh, yes.
Was this all Viet Cong?
Well, we're not sure about that. We think it was, and because that C-123 there, whenever it would be flying, we'd be going into Da Nang. That's where we took most of the hits, because you'd have to come up down over the river to be able to line up with the runway.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way you could keep the altitude away, and they would set up with gunboats. And, well, we had Navy there trying to control that too for us with gunboats to try to eradicate them, but we still wind up with getting shot at anyway.
What was it like? What was the feeling of being shot at like that, such a low level?
The feeling was real bad. One time, I had about $20,000 in a chest type. Well, it was like an ammo box. It was really, and it was MPC anyway. We used there, military pay certificate, and they would go up to denominations of 10. But anyway, I had that, and I was going to pay some troops, and I was sitting there, and I had my rifle sitting on my shoulder there, and I had my .38 pistol, and I was a flak jacket and everything, and I was talking to one of my crews across the way. He was sitting on the other side of the plane, and there was webbing, you know, the seats.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, we finished talking, and of course, I moved back, and when I moved back, I sat back in my webbing, the bullet came right through next between me and the box, and went through the ceiling.
Oh wow!
So I really was fortunate that did take place, because I'll tell you, it would have hit me right in the area of the under the chin, you know, because I was leaning over, and I realized then, you know, how serious that was. I said, well, I've had some narrow escapes before, but this one here is getting closer.
Oh man, I would have.
But other than that, I never was hit. I mean, well, I did have some when they hit us. Well, this is another thing. I'll wait to tell you that. It was when we had an invasion there on the base. They moved in with rockets, Russian rockets, and also mortars and different other fire, and then the air police could not contain them, and we had difficulty there. We lost about 20 aircraft. These were fighters, mainly. They was in revetment, but they were hitting them, and they learned later that the guy was he worked in the Vietnamese that worked in the barbershop. He cut my hair, by the way. And he was one of the informants that was giving them exactly where the places were and where to hit them.
Wow.
They later captured him, of course, and the South Vietnamese cut his head off.
That is...
Yep. Oh, it was some crucial point. And I had another tale to tell you about that, too, coming back from Da Nang one time.
Okay, well, why don't we take a break here for today, Mr. Clyburn?
All right.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph Clybert. Today is 31 August 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Clybert is joining me by phone from his home in Camden, South Carolina. Mr. Clybert, when we left off last time, you were about ready to describe this attack on your base there with the 12th. It was a rocket attack, and you had some interesting things to say about that. So if you would, can you please give me a description of that, the entire day, how it started? Take me through this whole incident, please.
All right. We were, awakened about, it was early morning hours, around, 5 o'clock in the morning, and we started getting hit with, they called them Russian rockets. Now, I don't know, but they made craters of up 12 feet in diameter.
Wow.
And deep enough that I could stand in them, and you could only see the top part of my shoulders. And we had several hits like that, of course, that I saw afterwards, you know. But in other words, it started about, as I say, 5:30 in the morning, and we headed for the bunkers, and that went on for probably a couple of hours, and there were, I'm not sure of that, but I think it was at least 23 airplanes, these are fighters, F-100s and other type planes, not our planes, were not hit, the 123s, but they did hit those in revetments, and so it was called in by someone which worked on the base, they later found out. And in other words, he was a Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, we wind up with, I think it was around 20 people that were killed. We had right next to the first sergeant's barracks where we were, we had 8 air policemen killed there.
Wow.
It wasn't one of the rockets hit directly in on the building, which was next to us. And anyway, it was quite something. Of course, they started out with mortars, the way I understand. And then from there, it was they overrun the air policemen. In other words, well, the ones that come in doing these different things. But they were working mostly from outside the bay, the perimeter of the base. And then, of course, the AC 47s, which we had Gatling guns on them, they finally, you know, were able to get up and get out of there and go ahead and fire on them and get rid of them. But that's what took place. And that was February of 67.
Okay, February of 1967.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, you mentioned that there were it started off with mortars. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So they were close enough to hit you with mortars before they started to call in the big stuff.
That's right.
Okay. Now, while this is going on, 5:30 in the morning, when it begins, tell me what you in particular are doing. You're first sergeant. You've got responsibilities as a first sergeant.
Okay.
What are you doing?
The first thing I did was to get started, to get my men, because we were not housed all together there where the first sergeant barrack was. I had to go I'd say a quarter. No, not that much. We were spread out on the base, and I had four barracks, well, four huts type, louvered type huts with screen on them, and I had to go to where those men were to alert them, to get them in, make sure they were in the bunkers. Then I had to come back and get some more, and then we helped with the air policemen that were killed there, some of them were injured and they died later, but there was 8 of them, and help with that, and then go into the bunkers ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So, what are you doing while this attack is taking place? Other than the things you just mentioned, when you're in the bunker, you said that this attack lasted for about 2 hours.
Right.
Are you just sitting in the bunker waiting for it to end?
Yes, we did after that. Once we got this cleared up, and then we went into the bunkers, and we were stayed until they give us the all clear to come back out.
Okay. Now, did you say that there were Viet Cong that made it inside the perimeter of the camp, of the base?
Well, it wasn't Viet Cong. What it was, they were the ones that I don't know how to say that. Whether they were, they probably were, but they were killed by the air police finally, you know, and then with other people involved on the base.
Mm-hmm.
What made it worse, we could have rifles, we have our weapons, the M1s, and the carbine, 30 caliber,
mm-hmm.
and we had that, and they were stored into the hangar, which was a half a mile away from us, and the ammunition, we had the weapons, but we couldn't have the ammunition at the time.
Now, why is that?
I don't know. This was a rule. You see, we were on a base that we were a tenant unit,
mm-hmm.
and they would not allow that because they said people drank and raised cane, and they didn't want them to have that. And I finally got that, not just me, the commander and I got together on that, and other commanders and first sergeants that this was not, we were in a war zone, and we needed to have everything. And the ones who would not behave, we would have to take care of that. In other words, if they did drink and have a problem, then we had means that we had established to control that with people internally in those huts, and also then with us as the commander and the first sergeant.
So from that point on, you had weapons and the ammunition available?
Yes, sir, later on, but not at that time. See, we didn't have that at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what brought that to a head. I had mentioned that when I first got to the base, and I was the wing commander, I said, no, the reason they didn't want to do that, we had too many people that were getting drunk and carrying on, and they didn't want to have them have all this together.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to be under attack like this without the means to defend yourself?
Well, it was really a helpless situation. That's frustrated me to a degree, but I was still able to, you know, go ahead and carry out my duties. But it was a bad moment, I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm. When you are in your bunker and you're being hit by these considerable size, these very, very large rockets, what is going through your mind when you're sitting there for 2 hours, knowing that you can do nothing about it?
I figured, you know, by the time the ones who could not get to the bunkers, if there were any, as far as I knew, most of them were there after I checked them. But some of these first sergeants could not check theirs because they were in a different area from where they were, so we were told to get to the bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. But it made it very difficult, in other words, to you were wondering, are they okay? Have I done all I can do that I need to do? And we were told, no, you go to the bunkers and you stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did.
Hmm. What is it like to be under attack by rockets? It's just a matter of whether I guess it would just be luck or fate whether or not one would hit you, one would land in or near your bunker.
That's correct, because see, one had already, which was very evident that they could do it, because they had hit the barrack, the hut next to us, the first sergeant's hut, and that was another thing that I questioned too, you know, why have all the first sergeants in one hut? Because that's the people who are leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, they changed that after that too. That's another thing that took a change. And we were housed in different areas, with the units.
What goes through your mind in one of these attacks? What do you think about while this is going on?
Well, I was thinking first, you know, of the safety of everyone, but then I was thinking of myself also.
Mm-hmm.
That, in other words, here I am, and there's nothing I can do except just sit here in the darkness of
of the bunker.
Bunker. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I lost it there. Anyway, and things run through your mind that you really sometimes can't rationalize, you know, really what next.
Mm-hmm. Such as what?
Well, if they continued the attack and they could not suppress them with the other folks that were there, we could be, you know, was all killed, or we could be captured. Was another thing.
Mm-hmm. What would have been your thoughts about being captured?
Well, that part, having known, you know, what some of the prisoners at the POWs went through, before this, in other situations, other wars,
mm-hmm.
And it actually works on you that you feel that we had nothing to defend ourselves. We didn't have the weapons. And we were been just sitting ducks, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Were you a religious man at the time?
Yes, I have always have been, since I was about 20 years old.
Did you find yourself praying in this circumstance?
Yes, I did.
I'm sorry, you say you did?
I did, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I did, and that helped me to get through some of that and then go back to my duties, you know, once this was over.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and
you
I
said
didn't just pray for myself. I asked some of them that was around me in the bunker, you know, did they mind if I prayed out aloud, and then I did.
Okay, so you even asked those others with you. Okay, okay. Did you find that they greeted that warmly? Were they open to that?
Well, at that time, they really did. Now, some of them made some changes after that.
How, you know, how
they,
so?
They didn't go to the services, but later on, they started going, you know, when on Sundays, especially.
Sort of put the fear into them, as you might
yes,
say.
Yes, sir.
I'll be darned. Now, you mentioned that they were after the fighter planes that were there. Is that right?
Yes, sir, mostly because this is the ones that they hit, see, because we had, well, we had C-47s there. We had the C-123s, which was the ones we did the, but none of those were hit in that area. Maybe it's because they didn't get it in. They were trying to get the fighters because they figured that would be the their best target to start with. Because if they could get them, they could not get up and get after them. The rest of the planes were cargo and, you know, transports and stuff like that. Like, and our providers were for spraying. So we didn't have anything that could do anything to them except, you know, fly out of there. That would be the only thing.
Well, that makes absolute sense. So they targeted the fighter, so they must have had some pretty reliable intelligence then.
I'm sure they did. And these were people that worked, these were South Vietnamese, well, supposedly they were South Vietnamese because they worked on the base. They didn't, now these did not work as, government. They worked like they worked in the, helping out in the BX, post exchange. The other ones were, the one that was really directing it that they really got and we knew about was the one who was a barber. And he actually cut my hair.
Is that right? You knew the man.
And, well, they, anyway, when they did find out it was him, the South Vietnamese police with the air police, actually, but the air police didn't have anything to do with that, but they just cut his head off. And I didn't see that now, but I mean, I learned about it later.
Now, was this the South Vietnamese National Police? Or the military police of the
troops, South Vietnamese troops.
Oh, okay. And you didn't witness this, but you'd heard about it later.
No, I did not witness that. I just heard about that later, what had actually taken place.
What was your reaction to that? Here's a guy who'd been cutting your hair.
Yep,
what was that like?
Well, I thought about that. I said, you know, you really don't know your who is your enemy in a situation like we were in Vietnam and, of course, many other the wars we've had here lately. But it just it made it very difficult to, you know, after that to say, well, you don't know who's who.
Did security on the base tighten up after this as
very
a result?
Very much so.
How so? Explain to me how it tightened up.
Well, they increased the amount of air policemen they had for the perimeter of the base. And then they also reinforced that with some Army troops, which was at I Corps close to us. And they would they had different types of patrols.
So they would go out into the they would go outside the perimeter, they'd patrol the immediate area around the base
right.
Then.
That's it.
Okay. Now was anything like this did anything like this ever happen again?
No, sir. The whole time I was there then we never had another attack on the base. That's the only time.
How did this attack change you, the way you perceived your security there, the way you perceived how safe you were?
Well, I felt we were very vulnerable, and even with the additional security, with the type of attack that had occurred, it would be difficult to control that. However, there was many other things that I didn't know that they had done. You know, that we talked about it later in meeting, that there was more security than we thought we had afterwards. They had the gunships, which were the C-47s, that they had set up for that, and they were in different, like some were at Thompson Hood, some were there, and other places, so they could move in and help out wherever they needed them in such a case as this. But then they also had helicopters that would patrol, and it changed things, and as I said, we never was attacked anymore of that type.
You said that 8 air policemen were killed, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, were these the only American casualties?
No, we had, I think it was 18 people total that actually, some of them were injured pretty bad and then died later, but it was 18 total people that were killed.
Did you know any of them personally?
No, sir. I knew them, by knowing them, you know, like the air policemen I knew, because they were close to us there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I knew some of them because they had come over with me overseas at the time. But not to the degree that I would, you know, what I'm trying to say is I knew them because we were traveling together,
mm-hmm.
and that was about it. And after that, I lost touch with quite a few of them anyway, because some of them went to other areas.
Sure. What was it like for you to have these men, your acquaintances with them, not friends certainly, but you knew who they were if you had to see them. What was it like to lose them in the midst of this?
Well, it brings it close to home, you know, when that happens. And you have some real concerns about that. And, you know, a life, no matter, what, like as you said, whether they're, you know, your friend, they are our forces, and they are American. They were Americans, and they were fighting men just like I was, and therefore it makes a big difference, because you, if you lose one like that, it's like losing a part of your family.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that, as I said, you don't know them personally completely, you know, but you, it does touch you. That's
okay, when the smoke clears, when you've got the all clear from your superiors,
right,
that the attack is over, that it's been put down, that the planes have gotten up and chased off whoever was firing these rockets, what is the aftermath? What do you do in the aftermath of this attack?
Well, when they give us the clear to come out of the bunkers, all the first sergeants were told, you know, to go to their units and make sure that everything was, you know, they needed an account of how the people had survived that, from where they were in their bunkers, from what happened, and that's what we proceeded to do then, and then go back to getting things back in line, you know, to do our regular duties.
How had the attack disrupted your regular duties?
Well, it disrupted it pretty much, because we were disorganized for, I would say, you know, 3 or 4 hours after they give the all clear, but to get things back in line where we could do the operations we were required to do.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that, as I say, our planes were not hit in that area where the hangar was.
Were you and your men involved in anything like picking up the debris, filling in these holes? Anything like that?
No, sir. No, not, this was done by the engineers.
Okay.
The civil engineers,
mm-hmm.
and other folks who actually take care of the, you know, the base and providing whatever we need, you know. No, this was not our, we didn't get into that.
Okay, so there were engineers who were permanently stationed there then?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and they took care of all
this
of that.
This is a civil engineering unit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what they're called, civil engineer, but it's actually installation engineering,
mm-hmm.
squadrons.
Was there anything in particular that you took from this to give to your men? Any lessons to teach them, or change the way that you operated, the way you approached your job?
Yes, we did. Colonel Dennis and I got together, and we said we really needed to have a meeting with we had to have two meetings because of some their duties involved other areas, you know, I mean, flying and going to spray and come back. But so we had two different sessions with them, explaining to them that how serious it was to be, we're in a combat area, and how important it was to make them understand that you're here, but because the liquor is easy to get, the drinks, you need to understand you can have a few drinks, but the point is you need to be very concerned about not getting inebriated to where you can't function. Because
mm-hmm.
we need each man to do his part, and we wanted to make sure they understood that. Otherwise, we would have to make changes in trying to, you know, limit their access to it.
Sure. Was there anything in terms of the way you went about your job on a daily basis that changed as a result of this?
Well, actually being visible, the commander and I, being visible to the men, and the way we conducted ourselves, I think had some to do. I had some to tell me that. I said, well, I appreciate that, but I said, this is the way that we need to all do that.
Mm-hmm.
We're here for a reason. We're not here to just, our life is as normal. It's we're in a combat area, even though that we're not in combat like the ground troops and the others, but still, after that happened, it made everyone realize that we were vulnerable and could get hit.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that your men in particular, or the people on the base in general, did you find that there was a more heightened sense of this kind of vulnerability,
yes,
and that they were more
really
careful?
We had a few that still said, if what else is going to happen is going to happen. I'm going to go ahead and have my drink.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, the ones in my unit, I told them, if you do that, you'll be dealing with me, I'll tell you, because we're not going to allow that. We don't want that. And I know you were sent over here just like I was. I didn't ask to come here, but we have a job to do. We signed on a dotted line, and we're responsible for what we do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned the use of alcohol here. What about the use of drugs?
Well, in my unit, we were fortunate. We did not have but one incident, and we corrected that and sent him to Tachikawa, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was cleared, and he came back to the unit, and he changed his ways.
Well, can you take me through that a little bit? Now, and you don't have to give me any names, of course, but take me through what this individual was doing and how it affected the unit and how the unit took care of this.
Well, I didn't get it clear exactly who he got the drugs from, but drugs were, at first, I didn't realize that. The commander had told me about it. And he said, yeah, there is drugs here in this country, and we have a difficulty with that with military. But as I said, we had that one incident, and it was picked up soon enough that it didn't get to the point. And then the briefing that we made with other folks, with the type of work we were doing, they needed to be as fit as could be for duty. And so... as I said, we only had that one incident.
Mm-hmm. What type of drugs was this individual using?
Well, now, marijuana was one of them, but then there was some other that I'm not, I can't remember exactly, that they had gotten from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This was a briefing from the wing commander, in other words, at the time after that, about the drugs. Different things that was taking place, with other units,
mm-hmm.
and other folks. But I'm not, I don't know if they had heroin or not. But I know marijuana was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you or your unit find out that this individual was using marijuana?
Well, he was one of the mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't not a flying status. And he came to work one morning, and his supervisor noticed that, he wasn't acting like he normally did. And so they started, he started to question him about it. He said, oh, no, he wasn't using drugs. Of course, naturally, he denied it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they set up, well, we set up, of people looking out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then an informant actually said, yes, he did see him do that, and went ahead and, of course, then later on, when we confronted him with that and got into the legal part of it, and he admitted it, and of course then the doctors checked him out, and of course then they sent him to Japan, and then he was able to come back to the unit and function as a normal individual.
Hmm. So when you found this out, you had someone say, yes, I can't, I witnessed him doing this, then what did you personally confront him, or did your company commander confront him? How did that work?
The commander and I both confronted him and his supervisor, the three of us,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that he understood that where we were coming from and what how serious a situation that was. And he even stated, well, the others drink and this and that. I said, it doesn't make any difference whether they drink or what they do. The ones that drink too much, we've already talked to them, and you, as a, using drugs, you cannot perform. You're performing maintenance on aircraft that these people fly, and we can't have that.
That's certainly coming in affected by the drugs on duty, which is
yes,
something
sir.
That wouldn't have been allowed, of course, drinking on duty. Now, was this individual brought up on any charges?
Well, we first, that's what we went to legal with it, and we were going to give him an Article 15.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I said, the commander, Colonel Dennis, was really, if you remind me of Jimmy Stewart, very soft-spoken, very fine individual. And I enjoyed serving with him. But he said to me, he said, Sergeant Cleaver, he said, I don't think that we ought to go through with that. We should tell him we're going to do some type of punishment, but it won't be that for right now if we can take care of this in the way that we should. And so we did not. We held it in that order, telling him that we would, but then we held back on that.
Mm-hmm.
And once he had the treatment and came back and proved himself, then we didn't do that. We didn't want to put that on his record.
Sure. So he was...
Because I think he was really... Well, I don't think. He was a good individual, but he was a young fella, and he just got mixed up with the wrong crowd.
Mm-hmm. So you gave him this option. You either go to Japan, Tachikawa, clean yourself up, straighten yourself out, and come back... And we can essentially forget
right.
about this.
Either that, or we'd have to, you know, go with charges and get him out of the Air Force.
Hmm. Well, it was a very generous approach, I think, for Colonel Dennis to take.
As I say, Colonel Dennis, I don't take the credit for that, because I was going to be a little bit more harsh as the first sergeant. But he told me, he and I talked then on the side, he said, no, he said, I really think, Sergeant Cleaver, we should give him a chance. He's been a good individual, good young fellow. We need to give him direction. And I said, yes, sir, you're right. And that's why we went that way. So I don't want to take the credit for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when this attack on the base was in February of 1967, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, when was this incident with the individual and the drugs?
This would have been... When we discovered that, I think it would have been in June.
Okay.
Because I was just getting ready to go on R&R to Hawaii to meet my family.
Mm-hmm.
A 1 week R&R.
Okay, so you did get to Hawaii then.
Yes, sir.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about your R&R to Hawaii to see your family.
Well, the R&R to Hawaii was really, I really enjoyed that and appreciated that, and it rejuvenated me to go back to duty there. And, of course, my wife felt the difference. She said, here I am coming back this way to the United States, and you're going back over there. I said, honey, that's just part of the program. And I said, everything is going to work out. And my daughter came with her, too. You know, she was 9 years old on that particular week. You know, it was the 21st. I said June. It was in May. May, I went. May the 21st of 1967.
How did you get to Hawaii?
We flew with regular commercial airlines that were chartered through the military for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Now, you make it to Hawaii. You're going to see your wife. That you have, I guess this has been about 6 months, about halfway through your tour.
How's that?
I said, it's about 6 months, I guess. You're about halfway through your tour when you get this leave, week's leave to Hawaii to see your family. What was it like meeting them there? What was it like seeing
them? At first, it was, you know, it was like a dream, you know. And after that, I was really so happy about that, and they were too. But then as we parted again, you know, it was a sad moment.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, I was able to handle that better than they could. Of course, my daughter, you know, didn't realize what the situation was completely.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, she, as I said, her and her mother, you know, had to weep a little bit before they left. But other than that, we did fine.
What did the three of you do on your leave?
Sir?
What did the three of you do while you were on leave?
Well, we went to the Pearl Harbor Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
We rented a car, and then we drove in different parts, went to the pineapple fields, went to different others, stayed on the Big Island. We did not go anywhere else after that, except to the beach, the different areas, went out to eat at different restaurants.
Did your family think that you had changed in the 6 months that you were gone?
Not really, because my wife said that. She said, well, it really has not affected, even with the situation with February. I said, well, it does to a degree, but I said that, in other words, so far I've been blessed. I'm not affected by it to that point, you know, that it would show.
You said that it was difficult to leave your family, obviously.
Well, it was, really. But as I said, being the type of person that I am, and I was able to carry that through that way, I usually keep a stiff upper lip.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it worked out. But I was sad. There's no two ways about it, because they were headed back to the U.S., and I was headed back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a number of servicemen say that when they took a week's leave, whether it was to Hawaii to meet family or, you know, wherever else it may have been.
Hong Kong or Australia. We had different areas they could go to.
I've heard many people say that it was more difficult to go back to Vietnam after they had been on R&R. But that was not the case for you.
Not the case with me. As I said, I've been a positive person most of my life. In other words, you know, once I got to be an adult. And that was instilled by my father and mother. You know, my dad was really strong on that, and he said, you have to just stand tall no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always remembered that. And even though that I knew I was going back, you know, in an area of that type, I realized that, I had 6 months behind me. Not five months, actually.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got back, it would have been 6 months. And anyway, I said, I have half of my tour done, so the other half, I'll have to work on it.
Mm-hmm. Did you keep very close track of how many days you had left?
Not really. Now, see, I had some people that would do that. They'd call it a FIGMO chart. And FIGMO meant that they were going home, you know, and some of them would get to the point. And that's the reason I didn't keep that. I knew in my, you know, just remembering that it was this month or that month, and then I'd be going home in a few months. But as far as counting the days, but some of them had charts made up, and that's what they called it, and they'd mark it off every day. And I told them, I said, what you're doing, you're setting you up for a real problem, because as they would get close to the end of their time, you would see the difference in them. The anxiety would build up to the point that even on some of their jobs, you would see the difference. You know, they wouldn't have the complete concentration as they did before they started that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was something. I encouraged them not to do that. I said, you know, you'll be going home in such and such a month, and then that's it. And you should work towards that goal. But as far as just counting the days, I never did do that.
You could look at this from a different perspective. You were obviously much older.
Well, that's true too.
Than these young men.
Right.
What did you think about these young men you saw, the young men that you worked with, knowing that you're dealing with 18, 19, 20-year-old men, and there you are at your age at the time, how did the war look, or could you see the war through their eyes to any degree?
Well, that was one of the requirements, you know, of being a leader and a sergeant, a first sergeant, to be able to relate to people of all ages. You know, I had some older than I was that outranked me as far as rank, but I was still their first sergeant. The point is that I always tried to work toward that, and as I said, I had a real good leader. Colonel Dennis, Robert Dennis, was one of the best commanders I've served with, and he was a man, as I said, that he could talk to anyone, and when he got through, he could get the message through them. And I learned a lot from him, even at that point, of speaking to people, as you say, of different ages, especially the younger airmen.
You're serving in 1967 in Vietnam. By 1967, the war had become very unpopular, I think it's safe to say, in the United States. What sort of attitudes did these young airmen show to you about their attitude toward the war?
Well, they felt that it was a lost cause and we shouldn't be there. Not all of them, but a few of them. They were really, you know, they said if they were not staying in the military. Some had planned to stay, and they said as soon as their enlistment was up and they got back home, that's it, they're getting out.
Mm-hmm.
Because they said it's going to be the same thing. You know, they knew what had happened in Korea and divided the country, and that said, this, and of course, this is exactly what happened after we left there. This would have been 3 years later, I think it was. 2 years.
What did you think about their attitude?
Well, I tried to explain to them that we had a job to do, and I know how you feel about it, and I have some myself feelings of different things that I don't agree with the way the political part is being handled.
Mm-hmm.
But we are actually armed forces individuals, and we need to serve and do what we need to do for our country, no matter what. And then whenever you're through here, like they said, they wanted to get out, and I said, that's your prerogative, you do that if you don't want to serve. I want to serve, and I want to, you know, of course, I'm going to retire when I get back anyway, a year later, you know.
What did you know about what was going on in the United States while you were in Vietnam? Were you getting any word back from your family or from the media about the growing anti-war sentiment in the United States?
Some. We would get some of that.
How would you get it?
Sir?
How would you get this information?
Well, through the Stars and Stripes, the paper we had in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get some, you know, from news, a little bit of news from we had the radios, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, my family commented something about it, but not that much.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really, it should be suppressed as much as it could from us, because really it wasn't a good thing for the troops there.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for the younger ones.
The effect that it would have on the morale and things
that. And it did in some cases, because some had gone and met families, you know, like I did with R&R, and when they did that and returned, they felt, you know, a lot different about it, because they said, well, we're not appreciated anyway, and we're sent over here, and we're trying to do what we need to do, and we're not being supported.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to really have meetings and try to speak to them and give them some information, that positive information, instead of all this negative stuff.
What kind of things would you say to them at these meetings?
Well, it was always trying to encourage them to remember that job one is what we're doing here now. And then you can think about these other things, and maybe people don't like us in here, in some in his country and others, and in our own country. But the point is that the ones that feel that way, they will have to answer for that someday. In other words, you know, no matter what, and it would be better that we just not let that work to make us negative.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to do this very often?
We had commanders call every month, you know, once a month we had that, and then we had other little meetings in different groups, you know, for different situations.
Mm-hmm.
But once a month we had a real commanders call, it's called. We'd have that in the base theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have as many of the troops that we could have there, and the ones that did not make that one, we'd have briefings for them later.
Okay.
The ones that were flying at the time or whatever.
When you get back from your R&R in Hawaii, you have about 6 months left on your tour. What were those last remaining 6 months like for you?
Well, I can't tell you that, you know, that I didn't have some anxiety myself. I'm human.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, knowing that I would be coming back home. But I always, even when I got back, I had a job to do that was, I had a responsibility with a bunch of lives, and that kept me busy enough that I stayed on track on that.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I had a commander that was, as I said, the best I've ever served under, and I've served under some good people.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, most, all the time. But this man was exceptional.
Was there anything in the last half of your tour that stands out to you? Were there any incidents, any particular people that you ran across? Was there anything that stands out to you for your last 6 months there?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
That I could, you know.
So you're staying busy, working with the men, and this is... time is going by. As you get close, I know you said you didn't keep a calendar for the reasons that you've said, but you had to be aware of when your time was coming up.
Yes, I was. I mean, that's what I said, but I did not keep. They kept a chart.
Mm-hmm.
With all the, and then they would cross them off each day, you know. You know, like, it'd be like 99 days and 98 days and 97 days and I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to see that. Well, not that it would really bother me. I didn't need to know that because I knew that I would be returning home, in other words, in December anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had missed Christmas going. So I would, they had actually agreed in that area that we, the ones who had missed Christmas, they would try to get them home for that particular Christmas, which I'd miss my wedding anniversary and also Christmas. Because I was married Christmas Eve of 55.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. So you owed your wife then, didn't you?
Sir?
I said you really owed your wife one then, didn't
That's
you?
That's right.
All right, so we're winding down. Christmas time is starting to is coming around. Your time to leave Vietnam is coming around. Take me through the process by which you left Vietnam in December of 1967.
The day that I left?
Just take me through the process. Sure, the day that you left.
Oh,
what was it like for you?
A few days before, the week before I left, I had a new first sergeant that come in to replace me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, well, I said a week. It was a couple of weeks that he was there. And we went over the different things, so I was busy, you know, showing him the different things, that areas that he needed attention in or what was being done here and there. And so I was still busy even up until the last 3 days, and I wanted to stay engaged with him to be able to help him, and he appreciated that. He was the type of individual that wanted to, you know, get into that. So it actually helped me to transition into getting out but still engaged.
Mm-hmm. So did you feel comfortable turning your airmen over to this particular first sergeant?
Yes, sir. He was a man, actually, he was senior to me by 5 years, and he was also senior in rank. He was a senior master sergeant.
Oh, wow. Was there any...
He was a seasoned individual. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't just thrown into that job.
So it wasn't like you had to train him. He was already familiar with the with what he had to do.
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay. So that, I guess, would have made it a little easier for you, I would think.
It really did, because some of the first sergeants I talked to, they were having very difficulty because the person that was going to replace him had other ideas about how he was going to change this and change that, and he didn't know anything about the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make it difficult for the individuals that were there, which changes, a lot of times that changes a unit naturally.
Mm-hmm.
With the especially a first sergeant.
Was it difficult?
If they have a real good commander like we had, naturally that would control that to a degree because he would control the first sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that would go haywire. I've been in units like that myself.
Was it difficult for you to leave your men when you left?
To a degree it was, because there's some I'd got so close to that they weren't just people in my squadron.
Mm-hmm.
They become real good friends, and I kept up with them, and I still do with some.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I've met some, and I'm supposed to meet some more October the 8th, 9th, and 10th, I think it is. We're going to be down at Hurlburt Field down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And this unit, the 12th Air Commando, meets every year there at that time in October.
Oh, terrific.
So we hope to be able to get together there. Well, I hope to be get that with again.
All right. Now, here it is, your day to leave Vietnam. What day was it in December? Do you remember?
Let's see. The day I left, I think it was the 21st day of December.
Okay. December 21st, 1967.
Yes, sir.
Describe for me leaving Vietnam.
Well, just as we got ready to get on board the plane, I was thinking of the men, you know, that I was leaving there. And then I was thinking of I was going to meet my wife and my daughter. Well, that really, you know, it was happiness one way and being a feeling of regret of having to leave these people there. But all in all, I was happy to be going home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like something that was starting as a dream, really, when I finally got on the plane.
Mm-hmm. What was the atmosphere like on the plane?
Well, it was very joyful. Most of them on there were so happy that, you know, that you could hear the different talks that we were going, and how happy they were that they left Vietnam and things were fine and they were going home. And then others said, well, they were having difficulties, you know, with family and this and that and the other, so that they didn't know they were going home, but they didn't know how it would work. And so I talked to some of them, you know, while they were sitting closer to me that were saying that. I said, well, just remember this, that if you will honor the Lord and you will understand how and ask Him to help you deal with these situations when you get home, it'll work a lot better for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, some were having problems, you know. As I said, I'm sure of being in that area without their family.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, of course, didn't show it, like I didn't, you know. But again, it did bother me some, naturally.
All right, when you come in to, I assume you came into California?
Yes, sir.
Did you fly into?
Travis Air Force.
Into Travis, okay. What was your reception like in California?
They were it was just unbelievable that the way that the people that greeted that flight when we came in, and I understood then, because I asked that question, were they doing that for all the flights? They said, yes, this is the way we handle this. We welcome the people back because of the things that are happening here concerning that war. And so it was very joyful. People, in other words, it was a real welcome.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. back in the United States.
Okay. That's typically not the answer you get, of course, for so many people when they come back.
I think some may not have had that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the particular flight, as I said, I was told that they did that for every flight. Now, I don't know that for a fact.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the flight that I came on, they were just as receptive to us as if we were, you know, dignitaries returning from a one war, in other words.
Mm-hmm. All right, you make it into California, and then I assume that your family was back in South Carolina, or did they fly to California to meet you?
No, sir. They stayed in South Carolina.
Okay. So from here, did you catch flights to South Carolina?
Sir?
Did you catch flights from Travis to South Carolina,
sir,
then?
I flew from there to Columbia, South Carolina. We stopped, I think, in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we did not. We stopped somewhere refueling. That's all it was.
Mm-hmm. What was it like to see your wife and daughter again?
That was really, it was more joyful then than it was in Hawaii, really. Because I knew that I would be back home with them to stay, you know. And that made a big difference because I was being stationed at Shaw Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
Back, you know, which is only 28 miles from my house to where my office was.
How much time did you have left in the Air Force?
I had a year because I had to extend a year to be able to forecast. Otherwise, they told me what they would do. I could stay in Vietnam the extra months and then retire early. I said, no, I'm not foolish. I'm going to extend a year and go back home now.
Okay. So you had a year there at Shaw then?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And what are you doing in this final year?
The final year, I was the assistant base sergeant major.
Now, how did you get this position?
Sir?
How did you get this position?
Well, when I signed in there, they already had, you know, set up people for different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And because of my background, they didn't need a first sergeant there. Well, I need to back up. I was really being assigned first to Eglin Air Force Base. And because a friend of mine who flew fighter cover for us, a major, helped me to get that change because he worked with personnel people.
Mm-hmm.
And he got that change so I could come to Shaw because I had my house here and I was going to work for DuPont then.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that then I didn't know what kind of job I would get. In other words, as far as it would be a first sergeant or whether it would be back in personnel administration, which it wound up being. As basically, I did a whole lot of things that I did as a first sergeant in that particular position. Because the sergeant major himself turned over the men that were working for us to me, as you know, to control them and to
mm-hmm.
work with them.
Right. So your time as a first sergeant kind of paid off for your last assignment.
Sir. All the time that I've dealt with people, from the time I became a first sergeant, it really helped me. As an NCOS, a non-commissioned officer in charge of a group, like at the school at Maxwell
mm-hmm.
and other places, it always was a plus by being able to do that, to deal with people, to handle people.
Mm-hmm. While you were there at Shaw, did you pay any attention to the war? Did you follow the war at all?
Yes, I did. That's one thing I did because I was still concerned about the unit and the different people that was over there.
Mm-hmm.
And at times, as I said, I was more affected in a way of thinking of what was taking place politically and what was happening in the country. And, of course, I was getting naturally bombarded with all the news here and information also through the base because we had SEAL people over there, you know, that was actually on, they would rotate back from Shaw Air Force Base to that area.
Mm-hmm. Shortly after you got back to the States in late January, February of 1968, of course, the big Tet Offensive of that year takes place.
Right.
What did you think about that?
Well, that brought back memories of what happened on February of 67.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, you know, this is really worse than what we had. It just, you know, it was just, it the way I understood it from what I was listening to the news and different things that I would get, bits and pieces,
mm-hmm.
It's just not the way we should take care of things.
In what ways?
Well, as I said, in other words, and I get involved with politics again. Their politics to me and war do not mix. We need the political people. That is a fact. And we need both parties. But we need to understand that the generals and the military people there in that area knows more about what's going on. Yes, the general there is responsible to our commander-in-chief, but as far as all these people making comments about different things, and this should be done this way and that way nationally, and of course it's more so now than ever,
mm-hmm.
The news media, I think, should be barred like it used to be way back in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Things were classified and you did not discuss them, and now things are being discussed that should not even be brought out. People should not have that information. And I think that really hurts when they do that. And it hurts the particular area we're working in the countries.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about the anti-war sentiment in the United States once you came back?
Well, that at first bothered me a little. And then I realized that people are going to be people. And, you know, I make mistakes, and other people do the same. As I said, we need what one thing I thought they should do with that part, especially to make sure that the American people understood what we stand for and what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. And you think that it was unclear to the American public about this?
Sir?
You think that it was unclear to the American public about who we were and what we were trying to accomplish?
I really believe that, because a lot of people just perceive certain things and then they act on that, and then they hear this from this one, hear this from that, and they say, oh yeah, this is what's taking place, they're not doing this and not doing that, or they're doing it. So really, and as I said, a lot of the news that was reported at times was not exactly the way it was received.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of that?
Well, one of the examples, when we were hit in 67, my wife learned about that through the news media, and they had actually given it to the point that they had almost destroyed Benoit Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hit pretty bad, and we lost that many aircraft, and then they hadn't given how many people had died, that were killed, but they had given about the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, as I said, some of these things, they need to be given something about the war, but as far as reporting it each piece by piece, I don't think the American public should have that, and also, when they do that, other people get a hold of that that doesn't need that, the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you serve out your year. So in late 1968 or early 1969, you are out of the Air Force. Is that correct?
Well, it was right. It was actually, they retired me the last day of, but my retirement date was the 1st of January, 1969.
Okay.
I actually liked 6 days of having 21 years.
But you'd had enough.
Sir?
But you had had enough.
Well, not really. As I said, the reason I decided to get out, if I remember, well, I told you earlier, but I mean, my daughter had been moved from this school to that school. We moved from the Air University to Shaw,
mm-hmm.
which was Montgomery, Alabama, to here. Then I had to transfer to here when we bought the house. Then I had transferred to Kershaw, because my wife and my mother-in-law wouldn't come stay with them here, so my wife went to Kershaw, which is 19 miles away. Anyway, we had to transfer the daughter to that area, Lancaster County, then back to Kershaw County when I came back. And I did not want to disrupt her anymore, and I decided it's best that I retire. I would have probably stayed 24 to 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, no, I have to make a decision, and they are important to me, and I need to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a job already lined up, so I said, this is what I want to do.
Okay. Once you were out of the Air Force, did you continue to follow the war?
To a degree. And the reason I didn't as much, it bothered my wife a whole lot. And so I said, well, I just, you know, the news especially.
Mm-hmm.
But I would read, you know, different things. I'd hear from other folks. But as far as watching it constantly on TV, I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd watch it some if she wasn't here or she was, you know, doing something else. But not that great an amount.
Mm-hmm. What were your feelings in April of 1975 when Saigon fell to the communists? Do you remember?
Well, that was, to me, was a low blow. That's why I said it really... I thought of all the young lives that we lost over there, the men that we lost, the money we spent, tax dollars, and then do something like that, which was strictly political, and it was just wrong.
A number of veterans I talked to used the word betrayal. That the United States had, the U.S. government had betrayed the South Vietnamese, or that the United States government had betrayed its own servicemen who served in this conflict. Do you feel that sense at all?
Well, to a degree, I might say, but I don't like to use that word like that. I just feel mm-hmm. that they let us down, but I mean, I don't like to use it like that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that way.
Okay.
I just felt that it's not right what they've done. We should have decided to make or let the people on the ground make the decision and go for it and go after Hanoi and just tell them it's either put up, shut up, or this is what you're going to get. And they'd know, just like we did with Japan and Germany, and this is the way that it should have been handled.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, of course, my perception of it.
All right. Now... when you look back on your time in Vietnam, how would you say that your experience there affected you the most in your life?
Well, it made me realize more about life itself and by what we enjoy in this United States and had been enjoying for years. And, of course, as it's being eroded as we go along through the years, and that makes a big difference in the way I look at it.
Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons did you learn about yourself as a result of your experiences there?
Well, it helped me to grow and understand that there is nothing that's a utopia or just everything is okay, you know, completely and perfect, and it isn't, and that we have to work together, and that's why we're called the United States. And I've talked to a couple of our state senators here that when we had the American Legion meeting here about a couple of months ago. In other words, if we keep doing what we're doing now, it's not working, and we need to change that. We need to be united. I mean, we, as I said, and a lot of them want to say, well, which party? I said, no, it's not just the party. We need both of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Either party, or both parties are good. It's just that we need to change some of the attitude and the direction of some, I mean, not just the attitude, but the attitude and the way they're being trustworthy of what they say and what they do.
Well, Mr. Clabbert, is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview?
No, sir. Except that I appreciate you taking the time to do that, and all of you people that are doing that, and I really do commend you for that.
Well, thank you very much. It is certainly my pleasure to do so.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you again.
Okay.